Kwaba. Welcome to Black Conscious Rising, the podcast meant to uplift and build on the foundation of blackness, because blackness is synonymous with greatness. I am your host, Ananda Africa. Today's guest is Mr. Stephen Hutchison. Mr. Hutchison is an entrepreneur, a philosopher, a world traveler, and a well-read author. His breakout book is entitled Power Thought, The Handbook for Consciousness. It is currently available at Amazon.com as well as AuthorHouse.com. Mr. Hutchison is a personal friend and mentor of mine for many years. He is a tax professional, and since the tax season is upon us, I wanted to bring him on and discuss taxes, collective economics, reparations, and a string of topics pertinent to the Black community. Once again, you are listening to Black Conscious Rising, the podcast meant to uplift and build on the foundation of blackness, because blackness is synonymous with greatness. Welcome, brother.
Yes, thank you very much, Ananda. Thank you for the introduction. Yes, we have been associates. I've been an associate of Ananda for a while now. We've learned a lot of things together. And I've traveled all over the United States. I've visited all 50 states, including Hawaii and Alaska. And I've been very observant. I've done quite a bit of reading on self-help, as well as books on economic background, historical books. I've met a lot of interesting people. I visited India. I spoke with a lot of people and learned quite a bit. And I'm happy to be here to make a contribution towards our betterment as a people, as a Black people.
So again, welcome to have you here. So I wanted to speak a little bit about the economic situation in Black America, since you are a tax pro, and get your thoughts on what are some of the problems within the Black community as far as economics. You know, how is it after so many years after slavery, we are still in part of this situation? It seems that maybe money isn't the answer. Maybe it's power. But is money power? How does that work? So what are your thoughts on some of the problems with the Black community as far as economics, and how do we overcome these problems?
Well, if I could address the problem, I believe it goes all the way back. It goes all the way back to slavery and the systems that were put in place, the psychology that was put in place, the institutions that were put in place, the criminal, what I call the criminal injustice system that was put in place, as well as the military structure. I personally, my conclusion is that all of these systems are implicated in creating an impoverished circumstance for Black people in America. So therefore, as we have developed from slavery until now, we have gone through discrimination, we have gone through so-called integration, Jim Crow, we've gone through so-called separate but equal circumstances. We've gone through the civil rights movement all the way up into this stage. And today we find ourselves in a situation where Black people economically are at the bottom of the economic rung, even below other immigrant groups who have come to this country after us. So the question is why? And from my analysis, the reason is because of the systemic racism in this system. Systemic racism, particularly against Black people, against the descendants of the slaves who were instrumental and who provided free labor to produce the wealth for this country. So this system, the American system, the Constitution, the political system, as well as the local government systems and the corporate systems and the criminal injustice system is in place in such a way as to reinforce the fact that Black Americans will not be able to claim their rightful situation, their rightful position in this society. As far as economics are concerned, as far as land is concerned, as far as ownership is concerned, as far as finances are concerned.
So you spoke about the system going back to slavery and how it was set up in order to keep us down. So during the Reconstruction time, right after slavery, we know that Blacks were able to get into office in the South, in political office. We know that some Blacks were able to get together and actually create business. You know, they had skills. I know in Barbados, they don't call it slavery. They call it the Princess Era. but they did learn skills. They learned trades. And they were able to use those skills and those trades in order to better themselves. Of course, we know that the system was set up in a way to where these people were, marginalized, disenfranchised. We also have Black Wall Street. You know, people were coming together. We had our own banks. We had our own grocery stores, hotels, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, there was a bombing on Black Wall Street. I guess what I'm trying to say is that we had structures set up to where we could pull ourselves out of poverty, even going back to the times of slavery or just after slavery. How do we get back to that point to where we can pull ourselves out of this poverty? You know, can we do it? Should it be an individual thing? Should I, you know, I try to become, you know, a millionaire, or, you know, should I try to pull up my community at the same time? You know, how do we go about that? What are your thoughts?
Okay, one of the things I like to address is you were explaining how there was an era and there are events in history that show progress of Black people post-slavery, okay, where Black people actually wore members of the government, even back in the 1870s. There were Black people as members of government, and Black people got the right to vote. But simultaneously, we have to realize that whenever any progress was given to Black people, there was always a backlash, a very violent, vehement, dangerous, destructive, terroristic backlash from certain portions of the white society. So even though Blacks were given the right to vote in the 1800s, there was a backlash from the Southerners, the whites in the South, and they took away that voting right from Black people just to show them that they were not actually equal and they actually did not have power. So that right to vote was lost after it was given for 100 years, didn't get it back until the 1960s. The voters' rights still in the 60s. So that progress. Then you talked about Black Wall Street and about how Black people were industrious enough to utilize their trades, their skills, their abilities to become self-sufficient. And that is also true. We have examples of that throughout history. Simultaneously, there are examples of white backlash, of whites becoming extremely angry, extremely fearful, and responding with violence, responding with lynchings, castrations, burning Black people's homes, killing them, executing them. And this was supported by the United States government. So even after slavery, after the Emancipation Proclamation, after the 13th Amendment, which ruled that slavery was illegal in this country, that may have been true on paper, but in practice, Jim Crow was in effect, whereby Black people were being hung, castrated, humiliated, violently attacked with no protection from the Constitution, no protection from the United States government, no protection from the local government. They were assaulted by the Klan, the Ku Klux Klan, bombings, endless amounts of terroristic fear and violence was perpetrated against that black people. So just like Black Wall Street was destroyed by white mobs, was burned down in Tulsa, Oklahoma, burned down to the ground by angry black mobs. So those black banks, those black real estate companies, those black mortgage companies were all destroyed. And people were made to feel that they had no right, they had no protection from the government, they had no protection from the police department, they had no protection from the criminal injustice system. Okay, so it psychologically, it created so much damage. This is a psychological damage that black people are dealing with as a result of all these activities today.
I often tell people we are in an age of psychological warfare.
Absolutely.
But with that said, you know, obviously the blacks at that time were forced by situations to use collective economics. They had to control their wealth, keep it insular. But as you mentioned, you know, the white society wanted to have a monopoly on the wealth. So how do we, in this day and age, you know, we hopefully won't have to worry about getting burned down in this day and age, but how do we get ahead when, you know, there seems to be a monopoly of wealth in America?
Now, okay, now looking at that monopoly, there's an analogy that's used by Dr. Claude Anderson, who wrote a very, very important book. He's written quite a few books, but one of his most contemporary as well as most important books is called Powernomics. Powernomics, the National Plan to Empower Black America, which sets up an actual systematic plan for gaining the empowerment, how we can gain empowerment. But one of the analogies that he uses is a monopoly game. And he says, in a monopoly game, the money has to be distributed equally amongst all the players, and then you all get to play. And whoever makes the best decisions will wind up owning the best properties, will wind up owning the utilities, and so forth. So may the best person win. But when you enter into a monopoly game and your opponent owns 99% of all the property and 99% of all the wealth, then your failure is imminent. You're going to fail in that game. It's not a fair game. So this is the type of situation we're facing. Therefore, the result of that, I believe the only way that black people are going to be able to empower themselves is that they're going to have to unify. They have to come together as a unit, because individually, we are powerless. We are powerless without unity, because as a unit, we could put our resources together. We could put our wealth together. We can put our brains together. We can put our energy together and can help defend and protect and advance one another. But we are powerless without unity, because there's no community without unity. And as a people, we will have no continuity without unity. So I think unity is the foundational principle for our advancement.
I agree. And you mentioned Dr. Claude Anderson's book, Powernomics. So,
yeah.
You know, Dr. Claude Anderson speaks about blacks before the Civil War, how we basically owned and controlled 0.5% of all the economic wealth. And to this day, we still owe approximately 0.5% of the wealth. And you had spoken about the 99%. to the other 1%, or at least 3/4 of that 1%, we would have to look at other communities within America and see how it is they're living. You know, everywhere you go, in every major city, there's a Chinatown, there's, you know, a little Italy. Most places, I would say in Chinatown, you know, you see the culture there. Some other places were just like Little Italy or places like that, Victorian villages. These were places that were at one point communities, but it just keeps the name now. But we see in some of these immigrant communities, they are controlling wealth. You know, in San Francisco, for instance, they recently built a hospital in Chinatown where, you know, it's all Chinese language there. You can go there and get medical assistance without having to worry about discrimination or poor treatment and hospitals.
Absolutely. You mentioned this.
Go ahead.
No, I was just responding to that because you were talking about like Chinatown, Little Italy, Little Korea, these places. They represent the exact principle I'm talking about unifying as a people. There's a principle that Dr. Claude Anderson introduces in his book. It's called ethno-aggregation, okay, which is it's a fancy word, but basically what it is it defines a voluntary concentration of individuals and their resources around their ethnic commonalities for the purpose of improving their economic and political competitiveness. The only way a group of people can survive amidst a place like the United States of America, where there are many different groups of people, is that you have to execute the principle of self-preservation. You have to take care of you and yours first. Charity starts at home. You have to take care of yourself first and your kind first. Then you are able to, quote unquote, integrate and make a positive contribution to the greater whole. But if you, as an individual unit, as a group or as a people, have no power, have no unity, have no vision, have no goal, then you will not survive.
Yes, yes. So unity has to be there for sure. And there, basically, that's a lot of things we could talk about as far as unity. But let's move on to this idea of legacy or inherited wealth. I know Dr. Claude Anderson speaks about that as well, inheriting wealth. You know, we're born with it. If we're not born with it, how do we get ahead? and I see that in today's society, you know, there are those Black people who make it out. They get wealth. You know, they get, you know, millions of dollars. You know, whether they're musicians or, you know, athletes or businessmen and women, they make a lot of money. But very rarely do we hear them speak about the conditions in the Black community. And from where I'm standing, it almost looks as if they can't. You know, they have to keep quiet on issues of the Black community. I mean, we see people, I don't want to call out any names, but we see celebrities, and they'll start a charity in Africa, for instance, which is great. But they don't do anything in their, you know, immediate, you know, city, wherever they live. And it almost seems as if if they were to give back and try to contribute to the Blacks in America, then their legacy would be destroyed. You know, their names would get smeared. Somehow their wealth, you know, they'll find some reason to take away that money. We've seen it over and over again. So it almost feels as if a few of us can make it out, but then we have to keep our mouths shut. So I'm thinking as a grassroots, it has to come, you know, this unity has to come as a grassroots. You can't so much depend on, you know, trying to make it out as individuals, but we have to, you know, work together from the beginning, you know, before we have money and on up to, you know, we get money in all spaces in between. We have to work together. Otherwise, it just seems like the system cuts us off.
Yeah.
I think it cuts us off.
Exactly. I think I think that's something which we definitely have to add to the equation and understand that that is what happens the great majority of the time. As a matter of fact, I was looking at this article with Nicki Minaj. She was interviewed in the Rolling Stone magazine, and the question was proposed about why don't black successful artists speak out against all the violence that's going on, you know, like when Eric Garner in New York was murdered by a police officer, Trayvon Martin, Michael Brown in Ferguson. Like, why aren't all of these, you know, gangsters, right? You got the hip-hop world mm-hmm. full of all these gangsters who claim that they are so violent and so vicious and so dangerous. Why are they quiet? It's like, yeah. You're always talking. You're always, you know, putting yourself forward as being so dangerous and, you know, no one can approach you. Well, why aren't you speaking about these things? Why aren't you using all of your rap ability to speak out? You know, and she, this was what she said. I mean, she thought that the whole idea, you know, that, you know, this violence was happening to black people was a sickening thing, you know, and that she did not like it herself. But then reflecting on the role of black artists in addressing a racist society, she also mentioned about Kanye West. Remember when Kanye West made the comment that George Bush doesn't care about black people?
Yes.
Remember that? Okay, she said that he was made to apologize, okay? And he received so much pressure that since then, basically, he has been quiet, okay? He hasn't said anything publicly about most of these atrocities that are going on every day. Another interesting statement she made is she said, this is a quote, it says, I feel like when Public Enemy were doing Fight the Power, we as a culture had more power. Now it feels hopeless. Okay. Wow. And then finally, I just like to conclude with as far as what she had to say was that she points out now that, you know, since Kanye West got torn apart, the lesson is, it's like, how did she say? She says, now you haven't heard him speaking about these last couple of things, and it's sad, because how many times can you be made to feel horrible for caring about your own people before you say, F it, it's not worth it, let me live my life, because I'm rich, and why should I give a F-U-C-K? Period.
Wow.
Okay, so now I think that mentality is probably representative of a lot of successful, financially successful black people. You know what I'm saying? According to the way they're reacting, you know, I guess they are, a lot of them are protecting their money. And they feel yes. if they step out and if they say anything about their people, if they defend their people, the industry is going to go after them. They're going to lose advertisements. They're going to lose sponsorships. You know what I'm saying? So
yes.
as far as I'm concerned, you know, this is it's a very unfortunate situation. But there is one thing I'd like to – go ahead.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, well, that seems like we should take the emphasis off of money and put it more on power. You know, we, you know, are not so concerned about being rich right away, you know, being comfortable, and we put the money in our community. I mean, we start our own record labels, for instance, we start our own distribution company. It's going to be an uphill battle, but we're the ones buying the music. Why not create and sell it to ourselves?
Exactly. Exactly. Become our own customers. That is, I think that's a great portion of the solution. If we become our own customers, we patronize ourselves. The same way, like you mentioned about Chinatown. Mm-hmm. Okay, I was sitting in a Chinese restaurant, and I was thinking to myself, I'm sitting here, I'm in a Chinese restaurant, Chinese people work there. And I was thinking to myself, what do Chinese people eat? My conclusion, Chinese food. Okay, So even if I did not come to that Chinese restaurant, the Chinese people will come. Who works there? Chinese people. Who owns it? Chinese people. Who's cooking? Chinese people. So they patronize their own businesses. You see, so even if I didn't come there as an outsider, they still patronize their own businesses. So they don't need me, but, I mean, the fact that I come there, they make more money, but they are self-sufficient in that way that they patronize their own businesses, which is what you just said.
Definitely have to get over that mental block and start to patronize our own business and, you know, give products that people want, you know, put our ear to the ground. I wanted to speak a little bit about reparations. I know that you're into reparations. I did the numbers some time ago. I don't have them before me, but I was looking at the fact that the United States, I believe, gave 22,000 or maybe $200,000 to each person who was interned in the Japanese prison camps here in America after World War II. Some of them stayed for a maximum of 5 years. Some were able to leave within a few days. Apparently, legally, they could all leave whenever they wanted to. But, you know, the max they spent there was 5 years anyone at any one time. So I went back and I looked at slavery, and I thought, okay, although we know that slavery was for life, there were some instances where, in paper at least, someone would be a slave to 21 or 25. So I said, okay, 25 years of slavery, you know, without getting paid. So let's calculate how much money we should get on that. I looked at the 40 acres. I looked at the land prices or the land value in Ohio, for instance. And I looked at the cost of the actual mule. And I combined that. And I combined that, and it didn't come up too much. But, you know, the idea that what the point I was making was that we paid for those who were unjustly put in internment camps. We paid reparations to the Native Americans. Actually, under George Bush, George W. Bush, there was a petition to get white South Africans who, you know, their ancestors stole the farmland in South Africa, to get them off of the land and get that land back to the black South Africans. And so trying to move those people off the land, both Tony Blair and George Bush had agreed to pay what amount to reparations. So this is a recent development. What happened, of course, Tony Blair got into an argument with someone and decided he's pulling out. So George Bush, you know, he decided America's pulling out. And so they left the black South African government to pay for those reparations for the people who actually left. So it was a whole scam. But the idea is that America has paid reparations to many, many people. And, you know, we're not getting reparations. How, if we were to get reparations, how should that look? You know, should they just give us a check or what?
Oh, that's a great question. That's a great question because that's a great controversy. Okay. And you have many, what I prefer to call Sambos. A Sambo is someone who, like, looks black, but they represent white supremacy, and they feel that that is their duty, okay? That's a Sambo. It's one of the characters from the book. Uncle Tom's Cabin. Uncle Tom's Cabin. There was a character in it called Sambo, and Sambo was the character who the white supremacist would use. He's a black person, but he would, for instance, beat. He's the one who beat Uncle Tom to death. He whipped him to death. This is one black person whipping another black person to death. So Sambo was the one who was happily, willingly to beat a black person to death to please the white slave owner, just to get his, you know, to be pleased by him. So, but as far as reparation is concerned and about how it should be distributed. Some of these samples that are out there, they are presenting it as, oh, black people, y'all, everybody just wants a check, huh? We're just going to give y'all all a bunch of checks so y'all can all just go out and use drugs or whatever stereotypical things they think about black people. So they try to make it a lasting matter, like it's a joke, like it's completely ridiculous. But actually, that's not how reparations work. Reparations, for instance, Dr. Claude Anderson he uses the reparations that were received by the Native Americans as a model. Okay, so in order for reparations to actually happen, we need models for how does it actually work? What's the effective way for it to work? And so part of reparations would be land distribution, receiving land dedicated to the group of people, industries supported by the government for the benefit of that group of people, including what they call trade agreements, which would protect that group of people from unfair competition. The United States has trade agreements with many groups around the world to protect them and their income by having dedicated trade agreements. It's like an agreement that, look, we're going to buy your product. Even if someone else comes and tries to sell it to us for less, we're not going to buy. We're buying it from you because we're going to support your industry. You follow me?
Yes.
Okay. Education. Either a reduction in tuition or free education to all those who are willing to put forward the effort to go get college degrees and skills to support the industry, tax credits toward that group of people to help them overcome the obstacles that were placed before them unfairly. As well as tax exemption status. Native Americans, their land is tax exempt, so they don't have the financial burden of paying taxes. Forgiveness, loan forgiveness, debt forgiveness, tax forgiveness, these are all different elements that would be a part of a reparations agreement. It's nothing as comical as just giving somebody some money and say, okay, you know, we're even. There's nothing like that.
Yeah. It's interesting. So how do we use our taxes as a way to get economic wealth, or how do we get ahead by using taxes?
Okay, I think as you alluded to before, it's not just about money, it's about power. Okay. And money should be used as a tool to attain power. What's the use of money? Money is a tool that you use to get what it is that you want. And one of the things that we need is power, okay? And taxes, since we pay taxes as a people, as Americans, since we pay into the tax system, we legally, constitutionally are eligible and should have representation. We should have lobbyists who lobby for our interests. Taxation without representation is unconstitutional. Now, whether or not black people are actually protected or included in the Constitution, that's a separate subject matter. But I'm just saying, aside from that, just going that, you know, there's some sanity in the system. If there is any sanity, black people are protected under the Constitution of the United States. Therefore, taxation without representation is unconstitutional. And if you pay tax, then you have a voice. Otherwise, what is the benefit of paying taxes? If you pay taxes, you should have a voice. If you don't, then you have the right to push. You have to push for your voice. But in order to do that, political power is based on unity. It goes back to unity. If there's just one or two of us, it means nothing. We're easily eliminated. But if you talk about there are what? Approximately 40 million black people in this country. Well, and the great majority of them are taxpayers. We have a base for putting forward our case for representation of our unique, specific, and particular economic, financial, and political agenda. But it requires unity. So based on that, that's one aspect of the taxes, using the tax base and the fact that we pay taxes as a power base. That's one dimension of it.
Yeah. So what, in your opinion, are some of the most important things we have to know about filing our taxes? Or, what are some of the most important things about filing taxes?
Okay. One is to understand basically what the process is all about. First thing, we all have to pay income tax. We all have to pay Social Security tax and Medicare tax. That's automatic. And most of us also pay state tax and local taxes as well. School taxes, we're paying real estate taxes if we own property. I think one of the first things is to become cognizant and become aware of what's going on. What taxes do we pay? It's just to be aware puts you in a more powerful position than just doing it knee-jerk and, okay, I paid my taxes and it's over. No, but understand this, because taxes are an essential element of financial advancement and financial literacy and your financial IQ. There is no such thing as making money and not paying attention to taxes. You have to be cognizant of taxes because all the money you make will be taxed. So you have to always be able to put taxes in your equation whenever you are creating an equation for your financial advancement. You have to include taxes as part of the equation. So the first step is just getting a basic fundamental understanding of the taxes that we pay, that come out of our check, like I just mentioned, those taxes. And then after you get your money and you go and you cash your check and then you go out into the world, you're going to be paying sales taxes on items that you buy. You pay utility taxes on your phone bill. And when you pay your electric bill, you're paying taxes. When you buy gasoline, you pay taxes. When you buy cigarettes, you pay taxes. When you buy soda, you pay taxes. So there's a whole gambit of taxes that you are paying. Become cognizant of that, because a great deal of your money is going towards that, and that's one of the reasons why you have so little money left over at the end of the day.
Yes. Okay. You mentioned school taxes. You mentioned the list of taxes and how we need to be cognizant of it, and so that made me think about it. I work in the school system, and I always say, if I was in charge, all the schools would be equal. There will be computers in all the schools. There will be updated books. Everyone would be equal. What I notice is that in the more impoverished neighborhoods, the schools, they're run down. You know, they're not getting the best education. They don't have the equipment that some of these wealthier schools are. I went to one really wealthy school, and the football field was manicured after the game is over. You know, the sprinklers come on. They actually have season tickets at a high school football team. But then there's another school I went to, and they were basically playing football on gravel. I mean, the dirt was full of rocks. And I see this disparity in there. But then it's the middle class who are generally – you know, stop paying all the taxes. You know, rich people get all these tax breaks. You know, so the middle class, and we hear a lot about the middle class. We never hear about the poor. But, you know, we see that it's the poor and middle class, or the working poor and middle class, who are paying the taxes. So is that something, you know, that we could take into consideration, you know, demanding that our schools be better since we're paying all this money? Or is that
Absolutely.
One way we can show power?
Absolutely. There's no doubt. Like, for instance, I live in Delaware County and Pennsylvania. And so in certain school districts in Delaware County, they receive, it's like $23,000 per student per year. But if you go into like Chester or you go into Philadelphia, it's like $2,300 to be changed, we need, again, a power base. We need a representation. We need actual people who represent our interests in our community. And again, it comes back to the principle of power, which you were speaking about. And power, one of the basis of power is that you control your economy, okay? Black people spend billions of dollars a year in different industries. Black people in the economy are considered to be the number one consumers. They consume everything from video games to DVDs to sneakers, hair care products, clothing. Great, great consumers. We are great, great consumers. You give black people money, they well spend it. That's the basic formula be understood. It's a basic formula. That's what we do as a people. Now, as a people, if we were simply to redirect our spending, even if we didn't stop spending, which would probably be even a better idea, but if we simply redirected it back into our community, we would create a revolutionary change. We would simply redirect.
I like that idea of revolution.
Absolutely.
So, if people want to get taxes done from you, how can they reach you? What company
they can
work?
Yeah, they can contact me by going to my website. My website is Stephen, with a V, Steven Hutchinson, StephenHutchinson.biz. Hutchinson is HUTCHINSON, StephenHutchinson.biz. That is my website for my business, Power Tax. Or they can contact me by calling me. My number is 610-955-6508. That's 610-955-6508.
And you do taxes for the people in your local area or all over?
Well, nationally, as long as they're in the 50 states, then I can do their taxes. Yes. And when I do taxes for people, I also try to assist them at increasing their financial IQ from wherever it is, because I believe this is essential. It's essential. Since we do taxes every year, then I think we should learn something financially every year when we do our taxes that will potentially put us in a better position, a better financial position the following year.
Yes, I've noticed doing my taxes a lot of times. You go in, you ask questions, you may get some answers, only to find out the next year that they didn't give you all the information you asked for. Whether they don't know it or they just don't want to tell. So I think the idea of you giving that financial literacy, I think that's a really good thing. It's a bonus. People should definitely check you out. It says StephenHutchinson.biz, B-I-Z, correct?
Yes, yes.
Yes. So I encourage your listeners to check that out. So we are at the 45-minute mark. I don't know if you want to go on or we can wrap it here.
We definitely could go on, but I think if we wrap it here, that would be good. And I am available, of course, to come back, you know, at any time that you invite me to, you know, further explore these subjects, because I believe this is urgent and it needs to be particular. It needs to be specific, because I think we have to address specifically black people in America and their issues. And I don't think those issues should be merged with all the other issues. Well, we're talking about people of color or colored people or minorities or just know specifically. I think the specificity of the problems of Black people have been looked over, merged, integrated, regurgitated so many times that we are constantly lost. We get lost. And then when you look at the ultimate result, you find that every other group in America has surpassed us economically, financially, on the education scale. We've been surpassed. So therefore, I feel the urgency of being very, very specific in addressing our issues.
I agree. So we'll definitely have to have you back on again. So, yes, I just want to thank you. Thank you so much again for coming on and helping us to understand these issues. And I encourage anyone who is hearing this to definitely get in touch with you if you haven't already filed your taxes, to get in touch with you and get a little bit of financial literacy under the belt as well during their taxes. So thank you again for coming.
Thank you very much, Ananda.
And I would like to thank you for tuning in to Black Conscious Rising, the podcast meant to uplift and build on the foundation of Blackness, because Blackness is synonymous with greatness. I am your host, Ananda Africa. And remember, wisdom lies not in what we know, but in the courage to acknowledge what we like and the willingness to be open to new ideas.